Hello and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto and I'm the director of the Roseman Institute at UCSF. Today we are talking to Nick Damiano and Sreya Mehta, founders of Zenflow. I met Nick and Sreya when they just started Roseman Institute 4 years ago, roughly the same time they finished their Stanford Biodesign program. We've been supporting Zenflow since then, and early this year, Zenflow raised a $31 million Series A round, and we are excited to learn from Nick and Sreya how they overcome challenges and what's up and coming in Zenflow. Enjoy the talk. Well, welcome. Thank you for joining me today. We have Nick Damiano and Sreya Mehta, co-founder of Zenflow. So I know you two met at Stanford Biodesign. So were you team up? Was it a project together? Or somehow you just interested in the same thing? And can you tell us how you got?
Yeah. So we were in the Stanford Biodesign Fellowship from 2013 to 2014 and were paired on the same team. They usually try to pair up people with complementary expertise. And so they had both of us together and then another two people. One was a general surgery resident. One was a sort of an engineer who had been a reimbursement consultant. So that was our team. And yeah, we worked together in the fellowship for a year. And then after that, decided to start this company.
Mm-hmm. What drove you to move forward with the project and start a company?
Yeah, I think part of it had to do with just kind of the risk appetite. I think Nick had started a company before, and for me, this is my first startup, but, you know, we were excited about the idea and thought that it would be, you know, viable solution, a good solution for patients and just a viable business. And so we started off just, you know, examining kind of the technical feasibility. And
so maybe can you tell us about what is you're developing?
Yeah, so it's a permanent treatment for enlarged prostate or benign prostatic hyperplasia. It's a permanent implant that goes in transurethrally. And what we found through our fellowship at Stanford was that patients were really looking for something that was truly a minimally invasive office-based solution. Current therapies for BPH range from either medical therapy, so drugs, but drugs don't work for about half of patients who start them. And on the opposite spectrum, there's the more invasive mm-hmm. surgical options. And so a lot of patients would go to their general practitioner and get prescribed the drugs, come off of them, mm-hmm. and then be referred to the urologist, at which point we'd meet them and they would talk to the urologist about surgical options. And then at that point, they would say, you know what, those are too risky, have sexual dysfunction side effects and other, you know, catheterization, all these things that they didn't quite want, and then would go home and basically just suffer through their symptoms instead of electing for the more invasive therapies. So we saw a need for a more minimally invasive solution that could be done in an office-based procedure.
So for the people who take the drug, is there any side effect as well? Or just...
There is. So yeah, I mean, a lot of, depending on the drug, one of the big side effects is sexual dysfunction. So that's sort of like with surgery, it's an issue that a lot of men don't want to deal with. And there are other things, you know, dizziness, headaches, things like that, typical drug side effects. But I'd say it's usually less so the side effects and more the lack of effectiveness, mm-hmm. but it can be both, really.
Okay. And so for a patient who had the symptoms, is that, like, what is their symptom if they have it and not treat it?
Yeah, so there are a lot of symptoms that BPH causes. So generally it's, you know, an inability to empty the urine from the bladder, and that manifests as going to the bathroom often, having urgency, weak stream, hesitancy where it's hard to even get started, starting and stopping. And the most troublesome one for most patients is getting up at night. So it's called nocturia, where men that have the condition have to get up 3 or 4 times per night and use the bathroom. And then they're standing there and have to strain, and it's really, really wakes them up, and it's hard to get back to sleep. So that's probably the biggest complaint from patients and the thing that they want most resolved. Once they can sleep through the night, then they feel a lot better.
So a little bit of your background, Sarah, because I remember you were working in the FDA
Right.
Is that from there where you go to Stanford?
Yeah. So I'm a biomedical engineer by training and studied biomechanics and studied a little bit of cardiovascular biomechanics and orthopedic biomechanics, and then decided to work at FDA. I was a lead reviewer for cardiovascular devices primarily. And the reason why I made kind of the switch to entrepreneurship was just to kind of broaden my you know horizons and look at med tech kind of as a whole rather than just from a regulatory lens. And so I found out about the Stanford Biodesign Program and decided to apply. And not necessarily with the ambition of being an entrepreneur, but you know the project took us to where it did.
Well, that's good. And for you, Nick, you were an entrepreneur before.
Yeah, so I came out of school as an engineer initially and worked in a couple of different industries, eventually landed in med tech just because I wanted to do things that delivered something useful to patients. And then after that, after my couple jobs in med tech, ended up starting a company with a couple guys that was a healthcare IT solution. And it was something for med tech companies. So it was still pretty close to the industry and really got into the entrepreneurial lifestyle there, I guess, and really liked creating something from nothing and building something entirely new. And eventually wanted to bring that back to MedTech, and for that reason went to Stanford Biodesign. And I think I, more so than maybe Shreya or even or the rest of our team, was really set on starting a company coming out of it. And so fortunately we had something that was good enough to start a company on. But yeah, I was pretty dedicated to doing that.
Did you have to convince Shreya? Like, let's do this, or is more that all come together?
Was there convincing him?
I mean, because you came in like want to start a company, you kind of like, oh, you know, I just want to learn.
I honestly think that the need and the excitement of, like Nick mentioned, creating something from nothing was kind of what gave me optimism that this would work out well. It gave me the confidence, and obviously also that Nick had an entrepreneurial background and, you know, had done fundraising before and things like that, gave me some confidence that we could work well together.
And in the fellowship, I think we asked a few times throughout the year, like, what are the chances of go ahead with a startup? And I think every time the other two members were very close to zero. Mm-hmm. And Shreya was sort of in the middle. She's in the most likely to do it. I definitely needed a co-founder, and she was also the best fit in terms of complementary skill set. And I think, you know, sort of having the entrepreneurial mindset. So yeah, fortunately she was willing to take the leap, and it worked out pretty well.
That's funny. Like it's kind of like you're matched in the same team, and then it just all worked out. After Stanford, you finish, and then what? Like you have prototype at that point already?
We had a really crude prototype coming out of Biodesign at graduation. And I think the primary need of really a minimally invasive solution didn't quite develop into a prototype until the summer after. We got a summer extension grant through the program and J&J. And so we were able to take that through the summer and understand the need a little bit better and get through more prototypes, do some cadaver studies on campus. And so that kind of gave us a little bit more confidence in the solution that we had and also helped us refine the prototypes and refine the solution.
Yeah, the summer was really key because that was the first year that Biodesign had this summer extension option. And I think it's been helpful to us and a lot of other aspiring entrepreneurs coming out of Biodesign. It would have been tough without that because we had something in the beginning that really wasn't, it was sort of half-baked. It wasn't really a real device, and it was not something we could really raise funding on. We didn't really have any proof in preclinical models that we could make it work. And the summer really got us to a point that it was much more convincing and almost to the point we could start going out to investors.
Mm-hmm. So that's like 3 months extension, or like when you say summer, is that 3 months that you got to, I mean, is it because you're like hardworking that things can be done in 3 months, or is just?
It was like an extension for 3 months of Biodesign. So we were still funded through that and didn't have to, you know, immediately go out and try to raise funding. And we had about 3 months after that, maybe 3.5 months or so that we were not funded and just trying to bridge ourselves to where we could raise funding. That 3 month extension really helped to get us there and get us through some of the early de-risking milestones.
I mean, that's when you start doing the fundraising.
Yeah. And it was tough going out in the beginning. I think this is usually the case. We had maybe 50 no's before we got a yes.
Okay. Well, that's good. I heard Starbucks have 200 no's before you got a yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a common story because usually you don't have your story figured out. Your product may not be there. You're too early on, and it takes some practice and some more progress, honestly, to get some people interested. And I think things first turned around, we got into StartX, then Y Combinator. Mm-hmm. Y Combinator came with funding. And that was really surprising for us that we got in because they had never taken a med tech company before mm-hmm. that. But that got us going, got us to have a little bit of funding to be confident we could, there was light at the end of the tunnel. We wouldn't mm-hmm. have to go with nothing in the bank account for, mm-hmm. for too long. And also helped us get some of the early investor deals closed.
And then so that's first round, if you don't mind sharing, like what, how big is that?
Our early seed was about $1 million. And it started with Y Combinator. Then I think we closed the rest of the deals between maybe December of 2014 and February of 2015.
So I assume you'd be like working in the office, like Nick, are you in charge of the fundraising or how do you guys split your role?
That's generally how it broke down, but there was definitely some overlap. We had to make progress with the product. That was probably the most important thing. We also had to get funding. And so those were the two main tasks at the time. And we broke it down more or less like that, but there was, everyone had to do everything to some extent.
So before you get funding, just two of you, and at what stage you start bringing more people?
I think it was June 2015, we hired our first employee. Before that, it was just, we had the typical startup story with me and Nick's garage and, making the initial prototypes, getting some animal studies, initial feasibility animal studies done. And then I think it was June 2015 that we got the office and mm-hmm. we got our first employee who's our principal R&D engineer.
Although his first, I think first few days or first week, he was in the garage, which
yeah.
I think builds character.
Now says he was excited about those first few days, so I guess we did something right.
We had Ron also as a consultant. Our eventual chief operating officer was a consultant doing a few hours a week since very early on. I think December of 2014 he started. So he was calls himself employee zero. He was there before, but only in a limited capacity. Then eventually he joined full time.
Okay, and how many people in your team right now?
We have 15 now as of a couple of days ago. So it's grown a lot. Most of those were hired in the last probably 6 to 8 months.
I know, because your office now is bigger, but then you have a lot of other companies that you're sharing. You allow them to share
of
your space.
We were, until February, we were crammed into a really tiny space. We had about, I think, 13 people by then, and we just were on top of each other almost, and I was spending half my day in the closet taking calls because there's nowhere else to take calls. And then now we've gotten a bigger office, and we have some extra space because you have to sign a long-term lease, and we do plan to grow over the next few years. So for the time being, we know a lot of earlier stage med tech mm-hmm. companies and have a few of them sharing the space with us for now.
Your space was an Oculif space before.
Yeah, it was Oculif space. So that was a biodesign alumni company, and they had a really good outcome, developed a great product, and we would go over there and meet with the team there occasionally because they were basically across the street from us when we were our prior office. And then once that opened up, we said this is the space for us, and it's really been great.
Like moving easier too. You don't have to.
Yeah, just had to roll things across the parking lot.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. Especially during the fundraising time, there's all these ups and downs. How do you guys keep on going like you said, it's really tough. Even when for the Series A, it's like relentless. And how do you keep going?
I mean, I think part of the motivation, especially during Series A, was we were getting at that point our first-in-man clinical data. And so it was just, in addition to obviously providing value to the company and having some more exciting news to share to potential investors, for us, it's just encouraging to see that we're actually having an impact on patients and that this is the right thing that we're pursuing. And so it gives us a little bit of fire in our bellies to keep on it and knowing that if we just got, this closed, then we could really affect a lot more patients.
Yeah, we were raising the round and our team was really bought into the mission of the company. We all, fortunately, we hired team members that shared our passion for what we're doing and really wanted to see this eventually have a much bigger impact on patients. And they were, of course, just seeing the initial patient impact. It was tough, though. I think there was a lot of uncertainty around when the round would close, if it would close. And at one point, we had a monthly update. At one point, we were down to 2 weeks of cash in the bank. Uh-huh. We actually had, I think, more bills due than we had cash in the bank. And some of the team members were a little bit uncertain. Some had never been at a startup before and hadn't, I guess they knew this happened, but they didn't maybe expect this to happen for us or didn't know how to deal with it. And it was great to see they all stayed on board. We told them, you know, we're confident in raising this round. It's never 100% certainty, but mm-hmm. we have great leads for investors. We should be able to get this done in time before we run out of money. And it was close, but nobody left, and they all stayed true to the mission and believed in the company. And yeah, it was great to see.
At that stage, how many people were working?
I think we had maybe 7 people at that point.
Yeah. Okay.
So it was a small team. We all were really close, and I think they all knew that MedTech Series A rounds, like the first venture rounds, really hard to raise in the current climate. So mm-hmm. we were going to have to climb a mountain that many companies fell down on. So I think we were straightforward about that, but fortunately they all had faith and it mm-hmm. eventually paid off.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, you know, your leadership somehow gave them a little bit more confidence, because at the end of the day, they have a choice, they can go, but then yet they don't. Is there something that, what style of management that you have that you think that create this kind of gel in the team?
I think you know, we actually did, we're putting together our company values right now, and mm-hmm. so we've been talking a lot just about what keeps us, you know, together as a team. Some of it, you know, what's working right now, some of it aspirational perhaps, but mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that we do really well is just we collaborate with each other really, really well. And even though we've grown as an office and as a team, there are no walls between us, you know, and we practice sort of inclusivity, and so we're all working toward the same mission. And yes, everybody has their titles and, you know, somebody's in engineering, somebody's in clinical or reg, but at the end of the day, we're all working toward the same thing. And I think everyone in our office does that really well. And so it's just exciting because you work off of each other. Everyone recognizes their strengths and their mm-hmm. weaknesses. And, you know, you find the people to make whatever task at hand happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that brings, that collaboration brings energy that keeps people together.
We were always really transparent too about everything. I think the last Silicon Valley episode had this value called radical candor, and that was something we were tossing around, something uh-huh. very similar.
What is
but
that?
It really is.
What is radical candor?
Well, I don't know what it means in terms of the show.
Okay.
But we had,
I mean,
we
I didn't watch the show, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, candor was one of the things we're talking about, or there was something I had seen somewhere else called radical transparency. So the hybrid of that is radical candor, I guess.
Okay.
Which, like the show was talking about. But that's, I think in general, we don't like to hide things from the team. We had a low cash balance. We had an uncertain funding situation. Or if anything else happens, if there were ever to be bad news from the clinical mm-hmm. side or anywhere else, we want to make sure the team's aware and has all the information. And we trust they're not going to bolt for the door the second something goes wrong, right, as they didn't with the funding situation. But we do like to put it out there and, you know, bring them into the our level of information, mm-hmm. basically.
I think that's good. It'll be interesting as the company grow, how much of that can you continue to? That'll be interesting.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, scaling now, it already presents a challenge when you scale from 7 to 15, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there'll be greater challenges as the company grows. But the point of this value setting is to establish what we are as a company, and as we grow, we'll put effort into staying that way.
Because I think sometimes people, when you show them a lot of information, they cannot handle it, and then they just, too much information. Some people would rather not to know. But somehow your team, I guess maybe it's a self-selecting, that people who you hire.
Yeah, it's not always, we don't always just put it out there and say there's this bad thing, that's it.
Right.
there's always a plan. Like we always give a path forward, or we talk about a path forward,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
you know, say, okay, this happened, but we can get past this. We mm-hmm. have a lot of ways to address this, and we can come out of it even better afterwards.
What inspired you to have that kind of management or leadership style?
I think both Nick and I were problem solvers, and we just, you know, it actually gives us energy rather than seeps us from energy. And so I think we look for that when we're interviewing and bringing people onto the team, just people who take a hard situation and figure out how to make it work. So, you know, to your point about self-selection, I think that's inherent to us. And so when we look at people who we want to be working with, it works out well that way. And that's obviously a really good quality to have in somebody who's working at a startup where right. there are a lot of hardships and there are a lot of up and downs. And you want somebody who has the sort of wherewithal and endurance to kind of go through the good and bad.
I think a lot of companies just say, I need someone who knows Nitinol or knows the regulations or quality systems and doesn't really think about the cultural fit. But that is one thing we do think about when hiring. We screen for, even though before we had these values defined, we sort of had an idea what kind of person we wanted. And that's been important.
I could not agree more. So where are you now with Zentalo? Now you got a Series A funding, and how are you going to spend that money? Not too quickly, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, well, I feel like MedTech is, the thing about the industry is there's always pressure on you to spend more and take longer, but we're trying to fight against that as best we can. We're about to get back into clinical studies again. So we did a first-in-man study. Now we're going into some additional studies. And so really, I think we're all looking forward to seeing more patients treated. We've gone and dramatically improved the device. So mm-hmm. have high expectations for how that's going to go. And that's really what our round was intended for, was to fund these clinical studies. So that's the work ahead of us, to build the best device possible and to get great clinical data. And if we can do that, then we should be in a really good spot.
Okay. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.